Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer host, here with you every Saturday, to bring you the news and top stories from the Military Times, your independent news source about your military. And first up from the top stories from the week, a woman charged over vandalism of World War II memorial. U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Janine Pirro, said on Friday that a woman had been taken into custody and charged with two felony counts in connection with the vandalism of the World War II memorial in Washington. Melissa Ferris was charged with depredation against property of the United States and destruction of veterans' memorials, Pirro said on social media, adding that the charges carry penalties of up to 10 years in prison. The World War II memorial on the National Mall was vandalized with bubbly soap and graffiti on Thursday, prompting vows from the U.S. government to find the perpetrator. The fountain bubbled over with suds, and the words, "Clean hands, dirty money," were painted on one surface, splattering the area with red and green paint. Along with her statement on X, Pirro posted photos of a woman who appears to be holding a can close to the red paint on the memorial. Pirro did not provide more details of the woman in custody or provide the source of the images, which Reuters was not immediately able to verify. Pirro has recently drawn President Donald Trump's anger for dropping charges against four people for allegedly vandalizing the reflecting pool after Trump oversaw renovations of the pool. The pool's condition soon deteriorated, with a peeling liner and algae blooms. Pirro blamed that deterioration on faulty installation in dropping the vandalism charges. Trump said in response that Pirro had folded like an umbrella. Trump appeared to link the reflecting pool damage to the World War II memorial in a post on social media on Friday, calling it an insult to Americans who had died in the conflict, saying, quote, "First the reflecting pool, now this. We are on their trail. Where do these animals come from?" Pirro's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Ferris could not be immediately reached for comment. Meanwhile, in more somber news, there are two articles concerning this. I will pull information from both of them so we get a more complete picture. Two dead after Apache crash in Texas. Two people are dead after an Apache helicopter crashed outside of Fort Hood, Texas, according to local authorities. Emergency calls reporting the crash came in around 1:34 p.m. Central Standard Time, said Cliff Coleman, a spokesperson for the Bell County Sheriff's Office, during a news conference Wednesday afternoon. The individuals were pronounced dead at 2:30 p.m., he said, directing additional questions about the military statuses of the deceased to the Fort Hood Criminal Investigation Division. Fort Hood at that time did not immediately respond to an inquiry. Earlier that afternoon, Fort Hood announced that an Apache helicopter crashed in Salado outside of the base and said that emergency services were involved. Brigadier General Ethan Devon, acting commander general of the 1st Cavalry Division, said, "Our immediate priority is securing the site and supporting the initial response efforts. Our thoughts are with the crew and their families as we await further information." All right, then to follow that up with this article that came out August 14th, so just yesterday, Army identifies two soldiers killed in Apache crash. The U.S. Army on Friday identified the two soldiers who died when an Apache crashed outside of a Texas base earlier this week. Chief Warrant Officer 2, DeAndre T. Huey, and Warrant Officer Seth L. Olmstead were killed when their aircraft went down around 1:40 p.m. Central Standard Time on Wednesday, near Salado, Texas, the Army said. "Our hearts and deepest condolences are with the families of the soldiers we lost Wednesday," Lieutenant General Kevin D. Admiral III, Armored Corps and Fort Hood Commanding General said in a release. "The Army is a family, and a tragedy like this is felt throughout our formations and our community." Huey, 34, joined the Army in February 2014 as a motor transport operator. The Army listed his home of record as Killeen, Texas. Olmstead, 25, joined the Army in January 2023 as a warrant officer candidate. The Army listed his home of record as Belton, Texas. The Army said a team from the U.S. Army Combat Readiness Center in Fort Rucker, Alabama, is leading an investigation into the crash. Okay, now let's take a look at some of the other top stories from this week. Bill seeks nationwide concealed carry for special operators. Senator Tim Shee, Republican of Montana, a former Navy SEAL who told police that he accidentally shot himself while visiting a national park, filed a bill this week to allow special operations veterans and service members to carry concealed firearms nationwide, bypassing state restrictions. In an announcement, Shee said the Special Operations Forces Concealed Carry Act would align the status of special operators with active and retired law enforcement officers who are permitted under federal law to carry concealed weapons across state lines. Our elite warfighters never stop serving, and this bill ensures the law reflects the trust they've earned through a lifetime of sacrifice, Shee said, adding that Special Operations Forces spend their careers protecting the American people with unmatched discipline, judgment, and professionalism. According to Shee's office, when Congress passed the Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act, or LEOSA, in 2004, lawmakers recognized that inactive and retired officers may need to respond to violent crime or terrorists while off duty. They also recognized that officers face ongoing threats from individuals they previously encountered while on duty. Shee's office explained that his bill would build on the framework created by LEOSA because individuals in special operations, quote, have completed rigorous selection and possess firearms training that meets or exceeds professional law enforcement standards. Congressman Pat Harrigan, a Republican from North Carolina, filed a companion bill in April. In a statement, he said that, quote, it makes no sense that an active or retired SEAL or Green Beret, someone who spent a career mastering firearms under the most demanding conditions in the world, has no equivalent recognition under federal law. While the bill would extend concealed carry privileges, it would also require participants to complete annual active duty level firearms qualification tests, as well as a Justice Department concealed carry class. During Shee's bid for a Senate seat in 2024, the Washington Post published an article about an incident in which Shee was cited at Glacier National Park for illegally discharging a firearm. According to the report, the park ranger investigating the incident interviewed Shee at an emergency room in Kalispell shortly after the shooting in October of 2015. Quote, Shee stated he was arranging gear in the back of his vehicle and that the gun, Colt revolver, 45 long, had slipped down the pile of gear, hit the ground, and fired. The round hit him in the right forearm and did not pass through, the ranger wrote in a narrative with the citation. The ranger also told the Washington Post that the revolver that Shee said had accidentally discharged was loaded except for a single missing bullet. When confronted with the details, Shee told reporters that he lied about accidentally discharging his firearm and that the shooting injury actually occurred during a deployment in Afghanistan. He said he didn't report it because a teammate's negligent discharge caused the injury, and he didn't want to get his teammate in trouble. So, Shee told the newspaper, quote, I guess the only thing I'm guilty of is admitting to doing something I never did. He added, it was a small price to pay to make sure that a whole team of really great Americans did not get dragged through the mud over this. All right. Meanwhile, in other political news, Senator presses Navy for answers on USS Abraham Lincoln deployment. Senator Richard Blumenthal is asking the Navy to account for conditions aboard the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and detail the extensions to the ship's original deployment schedule. The Connecticut Democrat, a member of Senate Armed Services Committee, sent a letter on Wednesday to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao, seeking information about the carrier's long deployment and reports of problems involving basic supplies, water, plumbing, mental health, deck safety, and mail. The letter comes one day after a Military Times report that detailed concerns of family members who said multiple sailors aboard the Lincoln had attempted to go overboard during the deployment, which has been indefinitely extended as the carrier supports U.S. military operations in the Middle East against Iran. The report also outlined various concerns raised by sailors and their families about conditions aboard the ship and the strain of the prolonged deployment. The Lincoln departed Naval Base San Diego on November 21, 2025, for a deployment expected to last 7 months. According to Blumenthal's letter, the carrier is now sailing towards its 9th month of deployment and, according to the senator, has gone more than 200 days without a port call. Blumenthal asked the Navy to provide the dates of each extension to the Lincoln's deployment, identify who authorized the extensions, and explain the operational requirements behind each decision. He also asked for a list of significant quality of life problems identified aboard the carrier, including mold, broken toilets or laundry facilities, inadequate water supplies, and shortages of hygiene products. Blumenthal requested information on when those problems were first identified and what corrective actions were taken. The senator also asked what measures the Navy is taking to assess fatigue, morale, mental health, and crew readiness aboard the Lincoln. Additionally, the letter asks whether commanders have identified increases in safety incidents, medical issues, disciplinary incidents, or other readiness indicators associated with the extended deployment or the number of consecutive days at sea. The Navy, meanwhile, has not provided a precise number of sailors who have attempted to go overboard or engaged in self-harm during the current deployment. The service did not respond to inquiries by Military Times, but in a statement provided to Task and Purpose, denied the report. Based on information available to the command, we have not identified an increase in reported suicidal ideation or suicide attempts aboard the ship, officials told Task and Purpose. The Navy also told Task and Purpose it recognizes that extended deployments place significant strain on service members and their families, and that the Lincoln has medical professionals, counselors, chaplains, fleet, and family support services available to sailors. Navy officials also said current reports from the ship confirm continuous access to clean water and functional air conditioning. The service also acknowledged disruptions to mail and changes to resupply and replenishment during the deployment. In his letter, Blumenthal asked the Navy to explain how it plans to maintain a carrier presence in the Middle East over the next 12 to 24 months if current operational requirements continue, including how anticipated carrier rotations could affect planned deployments, maintenance periods, and carrier presence in the Indo-Pacific and other theaters. The senator inquired as to whether the Navy believes current demand for carrier presence exceeds what can be sustainably generated under its existing force structure and deployment model. Concerns surrounding the Lincoln come on the heels of the USS Gerald R. Ford returning to Norfolk, Virginia on May 16th after a 326-day deployment, a record for the longest post-Vietnam deployment. And that's all for that article, but up next, a tale of intrigue that you may have heard about through social media earlier this week. This is the Military Times version. Trump swamps planes via catering truck after Iranian threats, reports say. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday he secretly switched planes in Turkey last month at the direction of the Secret Service, but that the plane he ultimately flew on was still more vulnerable than Air Force One. Following a NATO summit in Ankara, Trump was transferred from Air Force One to a military plane via a catering truck in an extraordinary deception prompted by an Iranian assassination threat, U.S. media reported. The White House did not disclose the change, and it remained a secret until the Washington Post first reported it on Monday. Some media commentators questioned whether the operation left Trump's aides and journalists traveling with him at risk aboard the plane presumed to be carrying the president. Trump told reporters on Tuesday, quote, "I think, actually, the plane that I flew on was at greater risk. I think it was at greater risk because that would be the plane I think that they would be more likely to go for." Trump was accompanied by several close aides when he secretly transferred from Air Force One to a smaller military aircraft in Turkey last month, the Washington Post reported on Wednesday. White House Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, Executive Assistant Natalie Harp, and Oval Office Operations Director Walt Nauta made the move in the catering truck with Trump, along with several lower-profile aides, the Post reported. No cabinet officials joined Trump in the truck, according to the newspaper. After a day of social media memes portraying Trump as hiding out in the catering truck, the image-conscious president, who often promotes memes of himself as a bold and courageous leader, said he was following the direction of the Secret Service, the agency that protects the president, saying, quote, "Well, It's only up to Secret Service. I just follow what they'd like to do. So I go by Secret Service and the military, Trump said. I guess there was a threat out there. I didn't really ask too much about it. I get a lot of threats, Trump said. The White House said at the time that the president was flying aboard Air Force One from Turkey to Britain. But moments after Trump boarded the plane, he left it in secret via the catering truck and boarded another aircraft for the flight to Britain. The Post said on Monday, quoting unnamed sources, Trump had taken a newly renovated Qatari donated jet to Ankara for the NATO summit, but unexpectedly announced he would use an older Air Force One when departing the country, a move that prompted questions about the newer plane's security. The trip to NATO was the first international travel for the new plane, whose speedy upgrades triggered questions over its cost and security, and took place as hostilities escalated with Iran, which borders Turkey. All right, that's enough intrigue and espionage for now. Let's move on to another top story from this week concerning the military life and medical care. DoD to launch pilot for some service members to freeze sperm or eggs. The Pentagon will soon cover the cost for service members to freeze their sperm or eggs before they deploy to a danger zone or are separated from their significant others for more than 6 months on orders. In a notice expected in the Federal Register on Thursday, the Defense Department will launch a 3-year pilot in September that will reimburse eligible troops to preserve their gametes before deployment. The benefit required under the Fiscal 2025 National Defense Authorization Act will pay service members up to $500 per year for sperm retrieval and cryopreservation and $10,000 per year for egg preservation services. Those eligible include active duty DoD personnel who receive orders qualifying for hazardous duty pay, those who expect to get such orders within 120 days, and those geographically separated from a spouse, domestic partner, or dating partner for 180 days or more. Military families and family planning advocates have lobbied for more than a decade to increase access to fertility services to include cryopreservation of sperm and egg cells before combat deployments, in vitro fertilization, and other advanced reproduction treatments. In 2014, the Bob Woodruff Foundation sponsored a one-of-a-kind 2-day conference on intimacy and family issues among the combat injured that highlighted the need among wounded personnel to have broader access to family planning counseling, gamete banking, and fertility treatments. Nearly 2,000 troops received debilitating injuries to their groins or genital regions between 2000 and 2013, and 307,000 service members experienced some type of head injury during the same time frame, injuries that sometimes can affect fertility and sex drive. In 2016, then-Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced that the Pentagon would begin covering sperm and egg freezing for service members, but the planned pilot never came to fruition following the election later that year of President Donald Trump. Military families have often spent their own money on cryopreservation as a safeguard, and in extreme cases, have paid to extract sperm from dying loved ones to ensure the possibility of advanced reproductive services. In 2019, the parents of West Point cadet Peter Zhu extracted their son's sperm after he was fatally injured in a skiing accident. They argued in court that Zhu had expressed wanting to have a family someday, and they wanted to preserve his sperm to provide future options. In Israel, since the start of the Gaza conflict, the military has started offering the option to retrieve the sperm of deceased service members when delivering casualty notifications, according to the New York Times. Since at least 2022, organizations such as the Military Family Building Coalition, Resolve, the National Infertility Association, and others have provided free cryopreservation services to some service members, but until now, no government assistance has been available for deploying troops. How the program works. Under the pilot, service members can elect to obtain preservation services at a military treatment facility that offers reproductive programs or through a civilian clinic of their choice. Commanders must validate eligibility as the Defense Health Agency does not have access to orders. To receive reimbursement, eligible troops must have written affirmation from their commands. Reimbursement must be requested within 120 days after covered services began, usually the date of retrieval, prescription, or lab procedure. Troops must submit itemized invoices and DHA Form 459. Service members could be eligible for the program more than once within the 3-year pilot. Any decisions regarding continued storage, disposition, or later use following participation, quote, are solely the responsibility of the covered member and outside the scope of the program, according to the announcement. Throughout the pilot, the DoD plans to study the program's popularity, its cost, continued feasibility, and impact on readiness, according to the announcement. And that is all for that article. Up next, concerning military culture. From tanks and rifles to Dungeons and Dragons, veterans' experience-shaped games' famous artwork. Before Larry Elmore became one of the artists behind Dungeons and Dragons' popular imagery, he was drawing tanks and rifles for the U.S. Army. Elmore had been drawing for as long as he can remember, but growing up in a family with limited means meant his family had to ration paper, he said in a conversation with Fort Knox Public Affairs Office reporter Savannah Baird. When Elmore was drafted into the Army after graduating with a fine arts degree from Western Kentucky University, the service gave him the resources to hone his craft, he told Baird. Once I got assigned, the Army saw my portfolio and realized I could draw just about anything from memory, so they put me on illustration work, Elmore said in the release. The Army changed the look of its field manuals in the 1970s to include more illustrations, and Elmore's talents were put to use. After studying objects, Elmore could retain their images and draw them from memory, including tanks and rifles, he told Baird. It was a God-given gift and I used it, he said. Elmore went to basic training and was stationed at Fort Knox. During his time there, he developed skills he had not learned in college. Illustrations in the 70s were just line work, pure ink, white and black, no grays. And they didn't teach you that in college. I developed those skills at Fort Knox, he said in the release. After completing his 2-year obligation, Elmore decided to stay on as a contractor. Baird reported, around that time, a new employee joined the staff and introduced the team to Dungeons and Dragons, changing Elmore's life. Despite his initial hesitation, he began playing the game with his co-workers and quickly became hooked, calling it, quote, the king of all games. Dungeons and Dragons was relatively new at the time, and its art was elementary, Elmore told Baird. He recalled that a fellow artist said he was going to submit his artwork to Tactical Studies Rules, or TSR, the company behind Dungeons and Dragons, because our art is much better than this. Elmore then decided to submit his own portfolio to TSR, which included drawings he had produced for the Army. Soon after, TSR offered to double his salary, hire his wife, and move them to Wisconsin, the release stated. Elmore said he immediately shook the company representative's hand and told him, "You just bought yourself an artist." He went on to create one of the most recognizable images in the game's history, the cover art for the famous Red Box set, which featured a warrior in combat with a red dragon. After 6 years at TSR, Elmore decided to move back to Central Kentucky and pursue freelance work for another 40 years, according to the Army's release. He recognizes the impact the Army had on his career as an artist. I was very lucky, he said in the release. Sometimes I think to be successful, you have to be good, but you got to have some of those weird breaks in life, and I got 2 or 3. All right, that was pretty cool. Up next, speaking of tanks and rifles, a military technology update. Patriot makers hedge on Ukraine production deal as officials question cause of holdup. Though U.S. President Donald Trump promised Kiev a license to build Patriot missile interceptors last month, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon have begun putting the brakes on a joint production deal as executives weigh what is feasible and the licensing runs into Washington's red tape. American officials are backpedaling, too. Trump on July 20th told the Financial Times that the U.S. has to be a little bit careful about who we license to. Despite that, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Saturday posted on X that the two sides have now reached an agreement. The glacial progress may reflect American defense giants' fear that Kiev could become a defense industry competitor, rather than posing risk to technology or intellectual property, a Republican official on Capitol Hill told The Atlantic. Their real worry is that the Ukrainians will find a way to improve the Patriot and then produce them at scale faster and for much less money than what the existing production lines in the U.S. could do, the official said, adding that the companies will publicly frame their concerns around IP theft and tech transfer instead. Ukraine's weapons industry, honed by nearly 5 years of Russia's full-scale invasion, has been booming since the U.S.-Israel war with Iran began in the spring. The conflict with Iran has drained an estimated two-thirds of America's pre-war Patriot Interceptor inventory, sparking discussions about inventory and strategy. The deal's current status is unclear, and American officials have yet to respond to Zelensky's latest comments. And lastly, for this interesting story from the Observation Post, TSA stops Alabama traveler for Civil War-era cannonballs in luggage. A bag belonging to a traveler tripped TSA alarms on July 18th after officers discovered Civil War-era cannonballs in the individual's luggage, the first cannon-related mishap since J.P. Morgan's polarizing legal proceedings. The inert cannonballs, which were, naturally, wrapped in paper towels, were discovered during the baggage screening process at Alabama's Gulf Shores International Airport and later determined by police to have been stolen from the nearby coastal stronghold, Fort Morgan. My first thought was, I couldn't see a fuse and I need to get some help quick. TSA officer Justin Dupree recalled in a release, I couldn't see the entire item but was scared I might have been holding a live explosive. Dupree noted the antique artillery projectiles ranged in size with the largest comparable to a grapefruit. I had never seen anything quite this unique, Dupree said. I've seen inert grenades and training munitions, but never an Indiana Jones-esque stolen artifact-type situation. A TSA explosives specialist and the Baldwin County Sheriff's Office were subsequently notified and determined that the cannonballs posed no threat. Law enforcement investigating the incident stated the passenger claimed to be unaware of how the projectiles were acquired. The cannonballs were later returned to Fort Morgan, the release added. Passenger attempts to transport illegal items, including outlandish weaponry, through the screening process are, of course, nothing new. In a more glaring example from 2019, a Florida man traveling through Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley International Airport set off alarms after his bag was found to contain a disassembled rocket-propelled grenade. That individual was subsequently taken into an inspection area where he told airport security he was under the impression he could bring the checked RPG on the plane. Inspection of the weapon itself revealed that the launcher was not in working order and the grenade was a realistic replica. The items were confiscated by security, and miraculously, the individual boarded his flight on time. Well, all's well that ends well. And with that, we'll have to end today's program. Thank you once again for tuning into Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer host, signing out.